Welcome everyone to TubaCast episode 13. I'm your host Christopher, and with me is my brother Matthew and my dad Alton.
Hello.
Hey.
I didn't think about it till the end of the week, but this is episode 13. We should have done something scary, like scary movies or something, you know, number 13. But we're doing trains.
Friday.
Yeah. Oh, dang it. I totally missed out.
Man, you screwed that one up.
Dang it. Hey, we should have done like movies that have scary movies with trains in them or something.
Are there any?
Yeah, there's a couple like Night Train of Terror or Terror on the Night Train or something. There's a couple that involve subways, like going down in the subways, and then there's like monsters or creatures down there. Yeah, I think there might be a couple other older ones too, but anyway, okay, well, we're going to do trains. Do y'all have any weekly news?
No.
None's really interesting. I was riding Sunday, I guess 6 a.m. on the 610 on the bike, and it was my bike, and it's second weekend I've been out since it got real cold, and I was going about 60 in a turn, kind of low, I guess, and the engine started stalling.
What? Wow.
Yeah, and when you only have two wheels and you're turning, you really don't need your engine to cut out on you. And so I was obviously fine and all that junk, but, you know, you got to know how to react and all that good stuff. But it's apparently something wrong, and I can't get the bike to run in fourth or fifth gear without the engine, I guess, stalling like it's not getting gas. So I got to take it in tomorrow morning.
Whoa.
Which means a 30-mile-per-hour drive all the way to the bike shop.
You take the scenic route?
I'm not sure what I'm going to do. I mean, I kind of want to take 610, but that's highway.
Yeah. Yeah. You might not want to do that.
Yeah.
Well, when I lived in Austin and I was going to school in San Marcos, that was like a 45-minute drive down Interstate 35. And it was a Saturday, and I had a Saturday morning class or a lab or something. And when I was coming back, right when I was leaving campus, the back tire was making this awful noise, like it was banging up inside the wheel well. And I got toward closer to the highway, and I pulled over, and I was like, man, it sounds like a flat, and there's nothing wrong. I couldn't see anything. So I started driving, and I got on the highway. It started, you know, 70, 75, whatever, and the whole car was shaking. It was just this loud noise, so I had to keep going slower and slower and slower. And by the time I got back to inside Austin, I was going like 30 or 40 on the interstate, which, you know, you remember 35 is not good. And so I had to take all these back roads to get to our apartment instead of driving up on Mopac and stuff. And so I was going, by the time I got back to our apartment, I was going like 15 miles an hour. So I pulled in, and luckily there was like a mechanic shop there, and I pulled in. I was like, man, I don't know what it is. I couldn't see anything. It's rattling. It's banging. I started at 75. Now I'm going 15. It's taking me like 2 hours to get home. Can you tell me what it is? And he walked out, and he looked at it, and he's like, yeah, your tread's worn down. Your radials are all sticking out of your tire. Like, it should have shredded a long time ago, like when I was coming home. But I guess because I kept going slower and slower,
You're lucky.
Yeah. Oh, man, that was horrible.
I was driving in my Civic to the medical center one day, and all of a sudden it sounded like – it was the evening, too, so you got to imagine it's kind of dark out and all that. And it sounded like the apocalypse was happening underneath my car. And I was like, I guess I have a flat. But, I mean, it wasn't pulling or anything, but it just sounded horrible. And so I pulled into some parking garage, and I somehow got in one of those giant, like, three and a half foot traffic cones under my car, and I was dragging it like a mile.
Wow.
No, I didn't run over it at any point. I think someone must have already run over it and squished it, and so it just kind of got caught on my carriage. But, yeah, that was kind of strange. I'm like, you know, you pull it off, and it's like, well, what am I supposed to do with this now? So I just left it in the garage.
Wow. That's crazy. I have a couple of weekly news bits. Number one, I'm selling some original art now to drum up some funds, and most of it is the paintings that I've done for theRetroist.com. So if anybody wants to buy some original art at cheap prices, you can go to ctupa.com. What else? I want to give a shout-out to a couple podcasts again. There's one called ZombieGirls.com, and it's ZombieGRRLZ.com. And that's a horror podcast where they review horror movies, but it's an all-female cast, so it's pretty interesting to get their perspective on the horror movies. And I also listen to a couple horror podcasts that are all male, and so it's really neat to listen to both review the same movie and see what the differences are. But they plugged our site. And let's see, also rottingfleshradio.com. And that's a pretty neat site. It's all about haunted attractions, haunted houses, haunted rides, stuff like that all over the country. And it's a pretty extensive website. And I'm actually going to be doing a print of one of their characters. And so I'm going to be working with them on that. So that's pretty cool. And theRetroist.com, he continues to plug us, so that's awesome. And also, I got to be a guest host on TV Ate My Dinner podcast, which you can find
at... Did you really?
Yeah, I didn't want to say anything, so I wanted you to listen to it, and it'd be a surprise, but I kind of have to put it out there on the podcast.
You didn't think I was paying attention during this part of the podcast where you mentioned it?
Well, I wasn't going to. I wasn't going to say anything, but... But I figured I'd, you know, I better. So, yeah, so I got to be on their 100th episode. That's at darkcrazy.com. And actually, Sean and Brooks from their show are going to be on our show here soon, and we're going to talk about action figures. So y'all stay tuned for that. Let's see, is that everything? Yeah, I think that's it.
Sounds good.
Okay, so anything else, or should we talk about trains?
Trains.
Okay. Tonight we're going to talk about trains. Who wants to start?
Well, you, because I'm not for sure exactly where you want to go with it.
Okay. Let's talk about train stories, train history, and we'll do model railroading another time because that's a whole nother podcast.
Yeah, that's good.
So, I guess let's start with. Do you have some train history, Dad?
I got some interesting things that I didn't know about train history. I read a book called Hear That Train Whistle Blow. I think it's actually a kid's book. I mean, it's not full of pictures, but it gives a history of trains from, and not trains themselves so much, but railroads, I guess. How railroads, where they started and then where they ended from like 1800s up to 2004. Interesting that they started in England, but then people from America were in England and they saw the trains and they said, hey, you know, this is great. This is a good way to move people and freight. And then they built the first steam engines in England, I believe it was, and then shipped them to America in the 1800 time frame. I don't know exactly what year. And then the Americans started making their own. They started building their own railroad track. That's what it was. And then I want to say after like 10 years, there was more railroad track in America than there was in the whole world combined, because we just went crazy after railroads because America's a big country. And it's stayed that way for many, many years. I think possibly it may not be that way now, and the only reason that's really that way now, if we may not have the world's most track, is because of Russia. Russia started, you know, laying track in the 1900s. But what was interesting is some of the things I learned. I didn't realize that back I guess it maybe must have been in the early 1900s, or maybe it was sometime in the 1800s, we didn't have the actual time zones. The book mentioned that if it was 12 o'clock in Chicago, the exact same time, 12 o'clock in Chicago, might be 20 minutes later or 20 minutes earlier, the next town. and the next town might be something different. So all the nations got together and created the, you know, the Greenwich Standard Zone, whatever, and divided the world up in 24 time zones.
Huh.
But what's interesting to me is that the four time zones in America were set by the railroads, so that they could you know, do their scheduling.
That's interesting.
I mean, they didn't you know, the world where time zones were made by whoever, but they actually created them in America. And then another thing was interesting. I didn't realize this. In World War I, there was a threatened strike. And I don't know if it was against the government or against the Pullman company. You know, they need lots of stuff made, and rail shipped a lot of things. Well, the workday was 10 hours back then. And they threatened to, they being the railroad unions and the people, whatever, threatened to strike. And so the government agreed to make the 8-hour workday the standard workday in America. And that's when the workday came out. And it'd be because of the railroads.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Another interesting fact in this book, I assume it's true, Russia needed to expand its railroads, and they needed the money. So they sold off a big chunk of land to finance their railroads, and the land they sold off became Alaska.
Huh.
Another thing was mentioned about the people of Siberia. Until they built the railroads in Siberia, the people in Siberia of Russia really didn't have a way to travel because, you know, it's so cold there. And after the railroads were built in Siberia, it allowed the Siberians to mingle with other people. And it was some of the first inter-Siberian, European-Russian marriages because of that, because they just couldn't get out.
Wow. Well, that's interesting.
That's, you know, that's some of the interesting things. And the other one is, you may have remember reading this, is that when America went west, the Indians were in the way. One of the ways, or the way, really, the way that the white people of America were able to conquer the Indians was not by shooting and not by chasing them away and all this. It was by killing the buffalo.
Right.
Because that was a big thing in how they ate. I read somewhere, you know, it said there was, like, at one time there was millions of buffaloes, not just a couple of million, like 70 million buffaloes. And after they started shooting them all from trains and other places, not just trains, but other places, there was like, they went from 70 millions to like 1,000.
Wow.
And
didn't they just shoot them and just leave them?
Lot of them they shot and left. They couldn't skin them all.
Yeah, man.
And they shot them specifically to deprive the Indians of them?
Yeah.
I guess, since they just shot and left them?
Yeah. I mean, they did. There was a lot of skins taken back to the eastern part of the United States, but, I mean, they didn't need millions of them. They had more buffalo than it hit people.
Man, that's just disgusting, because the Native Americans used every part of that buffalo. You know, nothing went to waste. And then you have
right. You
have the foreigners come in and just shoot them and leave them, and they can't use anything.
Right. So anyway, and the other thing was, I don't know if they taught this in school. They may have, but, you know, when they built the Transcontinental Railroad to link east to west in America, I think they started at the Missouri River and went east. No, went west. They went west towards California. And then they started in California and went east. So they went, Missouri went, and then they went west, and California went east. And it was the Union Pacific who started from Missouri and went west, and they used primarily Irish labor. And then it was the Central Pacific, I believe, not the Southern Pacific, no, Central Pacific, that started in California and went west, and they used primarily Chinese labor. So the immigrants built the railroads.
Hey, when they built that, I don't know that much about it, but it seems like that'd be kind of hard to get them to line up right at the end.
I was about to make that same comment. That's amazing engineering, that they could get
Because, you know,
the railroad to line up.
when you when you cut like a tree stump or something with a chainsaw, and you know how you cut one end and then you turn it around and kind of cut the other end and it never lines up right? And that's just cutting a piece of wood. Like, how do they get that? How do they get it to line up so perfectly?
Well, I believe they had the track already planned. I mean, they just didn't start from California and say, "Oh, we're going to go."
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
they already had surveyors and engineers and people map the route out. Because
I never thought of it like that.
Yeah, one of the things I found sick, saddening, and interesting is that in order for this to happen, the government had to entice investors to buy into the railroad. Because, you know, it cost a lot of money to do that, even if you did cheat all those Chinese and Irish people out of paying them good wages. It took thousands of workers to lay 4 miles of track a day. So they had to have it planned out. And the government gave basically subsidies. The route was given to the railroads. They were given the land and so many feet either side of the track.
Hmm.
And then what they did was they sold that land to people for homes and ranches and stuff like that. I don't know how much land it was on either side of the track, but they were able to sell it so that they could finance it.
Man, no wonder people hated the railroad. Bunch of crooks.
And you know, they one of the things they mentioned was that, especially about the Chinese, that when the Chinese built the rail, when the Chinese worked with the Central Pacific, I think the wage was $1 a day. But yet, if the Chinese had people that were engineers or surveyors or whatever, they still got $1 a day. Whereas if it was Americans, they got $4 a day. So they saved a bunch of money by not paying them the same amount of money.
And then they probably ripped them off in camp and charged them like 75 cents a day just for room and board.
They did. You're right. They did that. They did that. They charged them for that too, so they didn't make a lot of money. And then the other thing I read was it cost. If I remember the numbers right, it cost $16,000 a mile to lay track, and they charged the government $48,000 because the government did have to pay for it because it was their railroad at that time.
Wow.
So I mean, they made lots of money, but it was incredible what they had to do because they had to dig through mountains. They had to dig on side of mountains. They had to dig through passes and build bridges. You know, it was a monumental feat considering what all they did back then.
Yeah, it's amazing when you think about what you just said and thinking about the kind of tools that they had back then compared to now. I mean, it's almost unfathomable that they could do that with what they had.
Oh, and you know, there's that song about that guy who John Henry against that steam-driven thing,
yeah,
or whatever. Well, according to the book, that was true. I thought it was a folklore, but apparently it was true. That they had to drill holes through when they were making tunnels. They would take a hammer and a spike and drill a hole into the rock so that they could put dynamite in the rock and blow it up. And people did that. Well, somebody came out with a steam engine, a steam-driven thing. And John Henry says, I can beat that steam engine. And so they had a time frame, a certain length of time, who could drill the most in the rock. Supposedly, he won.
Hmm.
But he died because it was – he died right very shortly after that because it just killed him to do it, literally. But the book said that actually happened.
Wow. Interesting.
And then, you know, if you're interested in trains, there's the whole thing itself about the actual train, you know, itself with the engines, you know, starting out with steam and all the evolution of the steam engines and how they got bigger and bigger and faster and faster. You know, they started out with the small steam engines with basically four wheels, two axles, and then at the height of the steam, some of the engines actually had eight wheels and four axles, four in the front, four in the back. And, you know, they were huge, huge steam engines. And then you had the rise of the diesel electric. and really primarily, well, there's a number of reasons. One is, if you watch videos of the steam engines pulling trains up a slight grade, then it's just a tremendous amount of smoke coming out of those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, of course, they started out with wood, then they transitioned to coal, and I think at the very end they were using oil.
Hmm.
One of the things that, you know, that helped the diesel electric over the steam engine is that a diesel electric could drive, I don't know, let's say the diesel engine could drive 100 miles before it needed to refuel, whereas the steam engine might have had to go 30 or 40 or 50. It had to take on coal and it had to take on water. And then later on,
the water towers.
Yeah, that's what they had the water towers for. I mean,
the movies.
Now I think later on, they had water and coal on the tenders, but I don't know if they had water on them to begin with. The book that I read doesn't specifically state that kind of thing.
What's a tender?
The car behind the engine that would hold the coal.
Oh, okay.
For them to shovel it in. And he probably had water too. I didn't read a lot of information about steam engines themselves. Even though I watched a video about steam engines, they didn't talk much about that. They just talked about all the different types of brands and sizes of steam engines. Another interesting thing I'd forgotten about, you know, you had the steam engines, and then while you had steam, then you had the diesel electric. And then the steam, and then when the diesels had so much more power and could run so much further and so much cleaner, then the steam engines just fell off really quick. I mean, they were making, you know, hundreds a year. And then as soon as the diesel electrics come on, it just like stopped within 1 year. No more steam engines made.
Wow.
But sometime, I believe it was in the late 60s or 70s, the two big train companies in America, General Motors and General Electric. General Electric built a turbine to run to generate electricity. You know, most of them are diesel engines running a generator with the brushes, the way your generators used to be back in the old days on your cars, and then the actual wheels that turn is a motor. I mean, there's a motor built onto that shaft. Every axle on a diesel engine has a motor on it, an electric motor. It's a big direct current electric motor. They're called traction motors, but it's a DC motor. You know, really not a whole lot of different than one in your hair dryer, except it's a whole lot more horsepower.
So if you hooked one of those up to your hair dryer, man.
Yeah. So most diesel electric locomotives have one engine and then a generator or alternator. The newer ones have an alternator, that just like your alternator on your car. It actually, alternator in your car actually generates three-phase AC, and there's a rectifier, and it turns it to DC, and that's how you get power to your battery. They General Electric made some engines, some locomotives. They were like twice as long as most diesel electrics. They had two engines. Well, at first they had two engines in them with two rectifiers. Then they came along with the turbines. The majority of your diesel electric locomotives have they first started out with like a few hundred horsepower. Then they jumped up to lots of them having 1,500 horsepower. Then they went up to 2,500, and then they went to 3,000 horsepower. And after that, the engines, they've had problems getting past 4,000, you know, horsepower, because the engines just, they're big, they're huge, they just can't take it. So they made some locomotives with two engines and two rectifiers. So you could put 2,000-3,000 horsepower engine on there with alternators, and you end up basically with a 6,000 horsepower locomotive. Well, they come up with some of the turbines, and they were like 8,000 horsepower of locomotive power. I mean, it's just awesome. But they use so much fuel that they just weren't economically feasible.
Wow. So they don't have any of those anymore?
No.
Wow.
But they do some. They do have some pretty big engines nowadays. If you look at a lot of, well, Union Pacific was always big. I've read that, you know, they're big on power. They'd hook up five or six engines on a train and pull it. Nowadays, if you look at the trains running here through Edna, you normally see like two engines pulling them because each one of those is like 4,000 horsepower. Mm. The newer ones. So that's kind of my my part on trains and railroads.
Hey, so you said you were just saying that some of them have two engines on them.
They did at one time. They don't now.
Oh, I've wondered. Does it make a difference if the two engines are next, you know, like one after the other, or one's at the front of the train and one's way at the back?
Well, it doesn't really make a lot of difference, except that if you're going to put an engine in the back, you got to be really careful how you control it, because if the back engine is pushing more than the front engine, you're gonna wreck.
Oh yeah, that's a good point. I'm learning all kind of stuff tonight.
If you have two engines in the front and let's say one's pulling 100% and the other one's pulling only 95%, well, you're not gonna wreck the train. You're just gonna have a pulling power problem between the two engines. You'll end up essentially with, you know, whichever is the least power, you know. But you're not gonna wreck the whole train. But you do see some trains with engines in the back, especially if they're long, heavy trains. Back in the days with the steam, in one video I saw, they would have what's called a pusher. They'd have, say, two engines pulling a train load of, say, coal or freight. And then when they'd come up to a hill, at the bottom of the hill, they would add a third engine in the back because it took so much power to go up any kind of grade. That I guess, you know, back then it really wasn't an issue because the steam engines were going so slow because they were loading those trains up so much. But anyway, they do it, but you got to really watch how you control them.
Huh.
I also read that they still put engines in the back if the train is on a route that doesn't have a turnaround in a switching yard, and they're going to have to reverse at some point.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Oh, they hook the engine on the that's at the back backwards.
Well, they just put it in the back so that if they have to turn a train around and they don't have a chance, like in a yard with a round table,
right.
They have the second engine in the back, which now becomes your primary engine.
Oh, I see, and he just reverses.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's pretty smart.
Two-headed snake. Hey, I got a question, and this might make me sound stupid when it comes to physics, but so let's say you got a very long train and you've got four engines pulling it, okay? So, you know, when it starts off, you know, the engines, I guess, say they're pulling at, I will say 100%, they get the cars up to speed. So eventually they're, you know, rolling across Midwest USA. If the lead engine number one, is pulling at 100%, are all the other engines pulling at 100% also? Because if they were, wouldn't then the fourth engine be doing most of the pulling?
Good point. I'm not quite for sure about that. But I think, you know, I think a lot of that also has to do with the fact that they are electric motors. So if you've got a diesel engine pumping out, the diesel engine's turning an alternator, and you're putting, you know, volts and amps to a bunch of motors, and the lead engine is putting out, let's say the lead engine is putting out 90%, and the one behind is putting out 95%. Well, then that one's going to actually push that other engine, and they're going to end up equalizing. I believe that's what will happen because they're electric motors. They're going to end up equalizing, so they're all going to end up pulling the same amount. But it may not, you know.
Saying the motors will adjust. The electric motors will kind of regulate themselves.
That's what I think. Now, if there's some listeners out there who know better, hey, send Christopher an email and tell us where to go look, because I didn't see that in any of the books and stuff that I've got.
So that would mean if your lead train is going 100% and there's a train, your lead engine is going 100%, and the one behind him is going 90, they would equal out at 95 each. Because that the first one would end up pulling this the one behind him a little bit.
That's what I think.
Okay.
And I guess prior to that, before, you know, I guess back into steam, well, did they double up on ever steam engines?
Oh, yeah.
Then they were probably just jostling around. The two engines were constantly varying speeds as one would pull, and then when he would pull the second engine, he would lose speed to the second engine, which would then push the first engine, and then the first engine would get more speed and pull the second engine probably the entire trip.
That makes sense. Of course, when you're going up a grade, you probably don't notice that because they're both pulling so hard. If you're going down a flat track, you might feel that. I don't know. And then, of course, Matthew mentioned round tables. That was how you turned around steam engines because they basically were meant to go one direction because of the cab. Because where the engineer sits and faces, and, of course, there was a light on the front end. There wasn't a light on the back end, and they were really designed to pull, not push so much. So you had to go somewhere and turn the engine around, and the easiest way to do it was a big round table. You'd drive the engine on this round table, and it would physically turn the engine around, and it'd come back out on the same track going the other direction.
Those are pretty neat.
A steam engine can go in reverse. That's no problem. But it's just that it wasn't designed that way because then you'd be pushing instead of pulling. With the diesel engine, it doesn't. The engine doesn't matter because it's electric motor. It doesn't care if it's going forward or reverse. And some of the diesel engines had a cab on either end. So they, you know, you drive one way, and then you just have a sidetrack, and then you unhook the engine, turn and get off the track, go on the second track, hook on the other end of the train, you're then a cab, and take off. Although a lot of engines nowadays don't have that, they have the cab on one end. So I don't know what they do. I honestly do not know what they do for turning around nowadays. That's another question for someone who might know, because I see these trains going through Edna where we live, and there's two engines on the front, and they're both pointed in the same direction, and then each way they go. So I don't know where they turn around. I don't know how they turn around. Good question.
Huh.
You know, up on 610 North here, there's a giant train yard, which you wouldn't even think of, kind of within the loop. Next time I'm biking out there, maybe I can stop and see if I see anything, because it's on an overpass. But, it's like 18 tracks, switching yard.
They may actually have a way for the train to either go, you know, make a curve and come back around, or maybe they have some tracks at angles where the engine can go back and forth a couple of times and turn around. Because they've got to be able to turn around somehow.
Yeah. So I got a question for you. What is the use of the caboose?
Well, back in the old days, that's where the brake. I think the brakeman was in there, and his job was to check the train at the before a train took off. He walked the train and make sure there wasn't any problems. Sometimes in the older trains years ago, I guess, where the wheels turned, they had stuffing boxes, I guess, where the bearing material was. And sometimes if a brake hung up, it would get so hot it would catch on fire. So the conductor or the brakeman, whatever it's called, would walk the train. And then when they would do switching, that would be the guy that does the switching. And then, you know, the engineer drove the train, and these guys did the switching. And then I'm assuming then in the passenger trains, that's where the in the passenger trains they had other cars. So I don't know if they actually had a caboose in the passenger train. But nowadays, I don't know if it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, they were able to eliminate the caboose, and the guy that does that work now rides in the engine, and they have a little electric. They have a transmitter box at the back end of the train that transmits back to the front of the engine to let them know that everything's fine back there. It's train still back there. Pressure is okay and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
So why were they historically red?
I have no clue. That's a good question. I do not.
I imagine it's to make them visible, but I don't know why. I guess maybe to signify the end of the train to whoever was, I guess, watching it or maybe counting cars or something.
Yeah, that's a good question.
I don't know.
Where does a monorail fit in or a subway? Are they not classified as trains, are they? Or are they like a subcategory of a train?
Well, a subway would be a train. Most of your subways are two rail tracks, but they're strictly electric. Subway means typically underground. And even in your larger cities that have trains and trams and railways, they're generally all electric. So they have subways have I think most of them have a called a catenary, where the electrics are on top, and they have a pantograph that pops up and rides the rail, hits the high voltage on top, and then the rail is the ground as a return. And so there's no diesel engine, it's just all electric motor.
Okay.
They might have a transformer in them to change the voltage if it's AC. But a subway is a train. It's just a passenger train instead of a freight train.
And
a monorail is one rail. That's the type you see in Disney World, in Disneyland and other places. It's just...
Is that used for anything, or is that just kind of a novelty?
They might have more of them in Europe, but it's really not... It's not a freight or a passenger thing here in America. I think it's just, hey, we can do it, but you don't really see it.
One of the neat things, when I was over there, Dad, and I flipped through that book, we looked at that that train that was propelled by a giant propeller at the end of it, and it rode on a, I guess it was kind of like a monorail because it hung from the top.
Uh-huh.
But it was like a, well, it looked like it was just one single car, like I guess the engine, and the back of it was like a giant propeller, and it would shoot it down the line.
Yeah, it was called a rail plane.
Huh. Well, that's neat. I guess we looked at that Monday or Tuesday, and Wednesday at work I was looking on some blog, and they had all these old photographs of America, and there was a picture of a tunnel. Like it looked like an old, like a really old subway tunnel, but it was made for one of those rail. What'd you call it? A rail plane?
Uh huh.
It was made for one of those, but it was underground. So that was kind of neat. I'd never even heard of those before.
Well, the book that I have a rail plane in, it was made in 1930.
It's pretty.
That's the only place I've ever seen it, is in that book.
Huh. That would be neat to build a model railroad that has one of those on it that worked.
Yeah, you could do it.
That'd be pretty cool. I'm going to have to look online and see if anybody else has done one. We could be the first people to make a monoplane?
Railplane.
Railplane. That'd be neat to have one of those. So one time, Matthew and I, and Dad too, we got to drive a train.
That's right.
You want to tell the story, Matthew? You probably remember it better than me.
It was in Lafayette, Indiana, and it was Cub Scouts. It was your Cub Scout thing, and I just kind of tagged along. And I guess Dad was the troop leader, and he arranged it or whatever. And so we went out to, I guess, a train yard or whatever, and a bunch of little kids, and I think Dad and another adult were there, and then a couple of train guys. And, they showed us videos, right? Because I remember one of the videos we watched was about the dangers of playing in a train yard, because they switch cars, and when they switch them, sometimes they roll. And so you've got like a hopper car rolling at 20 miles per hour that would slam into other hopper cars. And, the video is like, don't be playing around here, because you could get caught and like get crushed between these cars. And it showed like video footage of these cars just rolling down switching yards, slamming into other cars. And I remember thinking as a kid that probably isn't the best thing to do for your cars, because a lot of momentum. But anyway, so we watched a couple of videos, and then we went out, and we hopped in, and it was the big diesel electric, and it was the engine, and I believe the caboose attached to it. I don't think there's anything in between. I could be wrong, though. And basically, each kid got – they split into two groups, and so one group was in the engine, one was in a caboose, and every kid got a chance to drive the train, I don't know, a couple hundred feet down a length of track, and then, you know, the other kid would drive it back and then forward and so on, and then you switched, and the kids in the caboose would get their chance to drive, and those who were formerly in the engine got to hang out in the caboose, and, you know, you got to see what that was all about.
Yeah. Hey, what about the little dongle thing?
So, I didn't know this. I thought this was pretty smart. They have this thing when you're driving, not to downplay what's all involved in driving a train, because, I mean, I wouldn't know the half of it, but, you know, from the eyes of a kid, and what we were doing was you basically sit in there and you monitor speed, you know, you get the train up to speed and you just monitor everything. And every 60 seconds, there's this, it's like a wand, a horizontal wand sticking out on the console, and you'd have to hit it or slap it or whatever. Because if you went 60 seconds without hitting it, I think a light would come on, and then after another 60 seconds, the engine would literally shut down. And that was kind of a safeguard, as if you fell asleep.
Yeah.
which is pretty interesting, because, I mean, if you're driving in, you know, Midwest USA, you know, you fall asleep, your train's just going to stop in the middle of the tracks. But, you know, it's better than the alternative.
Yeah. It's interesting they haven't put something like that in, like, these trucks. That truck drivers drive where they, you know, they're driving, you know, 12, 16 hours a day and they have problems staying awake, you know, something like that where it beeps at you and you got to hit it, not every 60 seconds, but, you know, or you could turn it on, like, if you know it's going to be late at night and, you know, you get sleepy at night, you could turn this thing on and it'd flash every minute or something.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a free one for you, Ford.
Yeah.
I think Ford makes 18-wheelers. There's a Peterbilt Mac. There you go. Get on that.
And then, let's see, remember that time we came down when we used to live in Indiana and we came down to visit relatives down here in Texas? We stopped at the Casey Jones Museum.
In Tennessee, right?
Was that where it was?
I believe that's correct.
And so what was the story with him? He two trains had a collision, and he stayed on for some reason?
Yeah, he stayed on to try to stop it, but he knew he couldn't. And I guess everybody – I don't know if other people jumped off or something like that.
I think the story was he was with a freight train, and they were on a rails, and there was something going on, and they were going to slam into the back of a passenger train, right? And I guess it was pretty much unavoidable. By the time they found out, maybe they were on a downhill slope or something. But it was unavoidable, and they were going to come up fast on a passenger train and hit it. And so he had the brakeman jump because someone had to manually slow the train down for some reason. And I believe he stayed on and gave his life to slow the train down so it wouldn't do massive damage to the train they were hitting and kill a lot of people.
Hmm.
I think that's what happened. I haven't heard a story in over a decade, but is that right? Is that what Wikipedia says?
I should pull that up. That's interesting that you know, I mean, I'm not downplaying what Casey Jones did, you know. I mean, that's great. But when you look back at history, about you think of all the people that have done things like that in the history of the United States, like sacrificed themselves and, you know, whatnot. And there's not museums for any of them, but there's a museum for that, you know? That's kind of strange. Like, how do you make a museum out of that? You know what I mean? Was there more to it?
They did a quite successful job.
Yeah, I guess, you know.
Well, it's just local legends. I mean, they have a Paul Bunyan.
Yeah, I guess he is like a folk hero.
Yeah. I mean, he did become a folk hero because I guess the small town he was from or whatever was like, oh my gosh, we can't believe, you know, little Casey grew up in. He did that, and he's a hero, and he becomes a legend, and maybe that area didn't have a lot of local heroes.
Yeah, I guess you're right. It's, I guess, because we saw, you know, we saw it when we were kids coming down here. I always just sort of had the impression that it was like this big national thing, but now that you mention it, it's just like a local folk hero. So I guess that would make sense.
Yeah, and it's like the museum is all grand, and he's this giant hero, statues and all this. And when you hear the story, it's like, oh, okay. I mean, again, not like you said, not to downplay it. He gave his life to save others, but it's like, oh, I thought he like was on the front of the train fighting off like Indians and griffins and dragons with his bare hands, while, you know, something like that. But it's like, no.
Yeah. So in any of those books that you were looking at, Dad, did they talk about the hobos?
No.
Because that's always been very interesting to me, the freedom of riding the rails, you know, and getting on and getting off wherever it goes and hanging out with your hobo friends.
Yeah, sure, that's a blast.
Yeah, it's all romanticized, you know, in the movies and stuff. I'm sure it's horrible, but I don't know, do they still have hobos? I mean, do they call them hobos? Or is that like just a certain time period when they were looking for work and heading out west? You know, I don't know anything about like hobo culture.
I don't know this for sure, but I think the largest amount of hobos, people who would move, you know, ride trains and freight cars, was during the Depression.
Yeah, that's always kind of what I thought. It was like that one period of time, and they were, I don't know where the word hobo comes from, but I wonder if people still like ride the rails. I mean, I guess now they'll throw you in jail real quick, but I don't know.
I don't know. I do know that, you know, a lot of the railroads have their own security, like a police organization, and they don't like you doing that. So, but of course, you have to get caught.
Yeah. There were many times in Austin I thought about hopping on the train and riding it down to from North Austin to South Austin, but I didn't know how to get back. You know, other than call somebody and have them come pick you up, but that's kind of weak, you know. And I thought about doing it here now that we got the new train, just kind of sneaking on and riding it to Victoria, but same thing, you know, someone's got to come get me. Or you got to wait for the next train, but who knows when that would be.
I think historically, the idea of the hobo is a guy sitting in a boxcar, you know, a freight boxcar, an empty boxcar, or one that's partially filled. And either the door is left open or he or she opens the door and they jump in and they get a free ride. Well, if you look at the trains that come through our area, actually, I haven't seen that many boxcars. So many of these cars here are... they're hopper cars. They don't have doors on the side. The doors are on the bottom, and they have doors on top. So you pop open the doors on top, and you fill them up with grain or plastic or, you know, maize, corn, alumina, anything, you know, that can be transported like that. And then they close the lid. And then when they get to wherever they're going, they empty them from the bottom. They have there's these cone bottoms, and then they open them up, and the stuff falls out the bottom. So if you're going to ride a train like that, you got two choices: sitting on top, which is not good, or at the end where the coupler is. There's really not a lot of room there.
A lot of the boxcars too nowadays are being replaced by the cargo car or the cars for containers. Containers, you know, from the container ships.
Yeah.
Because boxcars, you have to manually load by hand and unload by hand. And nowadays, they just take the containers straight from the ports from the ships onto the rail yards and take them to the destination. So those days are quickly passing of boxcar hopping.
Yeah, that's true. You just have to kind of sit where the ladders are on those hoppers and just sit behind one of those ladders. You definitely want it to be a short trip, probably. But anyway, I've thought about it, but with kids, it's kind of...
Bring them.
Strap right.
Don't let marriage and parenthood slow you down.
Yeah, I looked it up in Wikipedia, and it says a hobo is someone, is a person who wandered but worked, as opposed to a tramp who worked only when they were forced, and a bum who didn't work at all.
All right.
And, you know, the hobos, a lot of the hobos had carried their possessions on them. So they wandered from place to place. And walking is slow, so, you know, hop on a train.
Hmm.
Okay, so I looked up Casey Jones. It's on Wikipedia, and I guess this is right, whatever. I was 50% correct. So here's what happened. Again, according to Wikipedia. So Casey Jones was the engineer on a passenger train, and he was running behind schedule. He was going 75 miles per hour, which was very fast back then, but he wasn't in any violations of speed or anything. And he and I guess there was someone else in the front car with him, a Mr. Jim. And up ahead on the track, there was a curve, and past the curve there was a train. There's a train wreck with a freighter. A freight train, and as Casey Jones's train rounded the corner, there was also a lot of fog, and all of a sudden they saw the caboose lights. And maybe this is also why you have a caboose, was because that was like your brake lights, because most of the cars, I guess, didn't have individual lights, right? So caboose is like your brake light. And it was too late to slow down, so he basically told Jim, you know, hey, save yourself, jump. Jim did jump. Survived, but suffered a minor concussion, and Casey Jones slammed on the brakes, and in a very, very short distance, he reduced speed from 75 to 35, and two trains collided. Again, he was a passenger train in the back that hit the stopped freight train in the front, and in the crash, he was the only fatality. Everyone else, at most, suffered minor injuries. So he gave his life to save his passengers, and he couldn't jump because he was pulling the brakes to do so.
Wow. Hey, I wonder if what was that guy's name? Big Jim?
Just Jim.
Oh, just Jim. Jim. I was wondering if if he jumped like when he said like jump now, or if he waited till he slowed down more, because jumping when you're going 75.
Well, his name was Webb.
What?
Sorry. His name was Webb, but Casey referred to him as Sim. it's saying as soon as they found out, Webb found out, he said, oh my lord, there's something on the main line. Jones quickly yelled back, jump, Sim, jump, and Webb crouched down and jumped.
Dang, 75 miles an hour.
Did not jump. Yeah.
He's lucky he
jumped
lived.
About 300 feet before the impact. Oh wait, he jumped and landed 300 feet from the impact site.
Wow.
So that's how close they were. Only 300 feet away. And in distance of 300 feet, Casey slowed a large train going 75 miles per hour to just 35.
Wow. Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah, definitely a hero.
Well, I guess the other way, the way you told it, he would have ran into the passenger car and hurt people that way too, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
The engineer was killed outright by the concussion. His body was found lying under the cab with his skull crushed and his right arm torn from its socket.
Whoa.
Lovely.
Wow. It was under the cab?
Well, I imagine the engine was all over the place.
Wow. Yeah, actually, in that book that had, they showed an engine train wreck where one engine was on top of the other engine. Like an old steam engine. Like it ran into the other engine. There are no cars, but it just showed one steam engine on top of the other one.
Yeah, how's that happen?
Yeah, I don't know. That's crazy.
When I was in Korea, I was walking through one of the parking lots, the apartment, and there were a couple people, I think, standing around. I looked over, and there was one car, like, 70% ramped up on top of another car.
Wow.
In a parking lot. I was like, how does that even happen? You know, I mean, because there wouldn't be enough room to get up to speed, like ramp up on the car, and the cars weren't totally mangled. It was just like it was placed there. But I mean, it's like, how did that happen?
Maybe someone's pulling up.
Totally, of course.
Maybe they're pulling a prank. Prank, yeah.
Yeah, but that's a total different story from a train engine.
Yeah. That'd be a crazy prank. Hey, look what we did to your train. Oh, you guys.
Wah, wah, wah.
That's all I have in my notes. Anybody else have any other train stories or history?
I've got more train stories, but we probably are at time, so we can
need to come
always.
Over.
We need to come over there.
Mom said hello.
Oh,
you couldn't hear her. I said you need to come over here to the microphone. She said hello, boys.
Hello, Mom.
Hello, Mother. Hey, you know what we can do? I've been wanting to ride one of these Texas steam engines. There's a around Austin, there's a steam engine line, and it's like a day trip.
Yeah.
You know, you pay, I don't know, whatever. And I've been meaning to do that forever. You know, it'd be pretty cool. Is, I guess maybe when your kids get old enough to get a job and pay for me to do it, then. No, but when maybe gets old enough, maybe she's still enough now, maybe whenever. But, you know, I can head on over and we can take a chain trip, and then we can talk about that on a podcast. And, you know, that can be like the highlight. And then from there, we can talk about the other times we've ridden trains. Because, you know, I've ridden trains kind of all over the world. So.
Yeah, well, actually, one of those that you're, those steam lines in Austin, we rode when we lived there. But the steam engine was in a shop, so they just used like a diesel. But all the cars were, you know, the old cars from, I guess, the 20s or 30s. And we rode it. It was like a two-hour train ride up through kind of the hill country, but it's a lot of like fields and just land with shrubs or whatever. And you go up and you stop at some little town that's got like an old town square, and you have lunch, and you got like 2 hours to like just antique or whatever they had there. It's just a little town, but they put on a like a Wild West show where they had a little gunfight. And you could watch that, and I actually got to be part of that, which was pretty cool. But then, you know, you get back on the train, and you come back. But it was really cool. I think when you got to one of the towns, they stopped or slowed down enough. I don't remember. And, like, these train robbers got on, and they kind of walked through the cars and, like, act like they were robbing the train. And then they got off at, like, the next town or something. Because you go through a whole bunch of these little bitty towns. But anyway, yeah, it's really cool. I think there's a couple of different ones. So, yeah, it's really neat. Ariana's old enough to go now. Actually, last week we were doing something about or watching something and had a train on it. And she said something like, I'll never get to ride a train. And I was like, oh, yeah, there's a couple of them around here. But, yeah, that'd actually be a lot of fun to go do that and then talk about it.
Yeah. I got a total different comment for you, Christopher. Totally switching gears here. I finished watching Sky Commanders.
Oh, yeah?
And the second to last episode is called Deep Freeze.
Uh-huh.
And in it, people die.
For real?
You never ever see any kids, anybody die in 80s cartoon. In this... the first time it happened, because I was only half watching it, the bad guys were going across, you know, cables and ropes, and one cable snaps, and this guy falls, and he's screaming, and he's kind of falling towards a rock way below, and it cuts to the main bad guy, and he's like, that's the third one we've lost.
Whoa.
Yeah, and another, like, a vehicle blew up with a guy in it, and then they killed two monsters, like, a monster grabbed another monster, and they both fell down into the lava and perished. And it was like, well, I mean, you didn't really see anybody die in any of the other episodes, but this episode, maybe because it was the second to last one, I don't know, maybe they got kind of bold, but yeah, bad guys were dying in it, and it wasn't discreet. They were, you know.
Wow. That's crazy. It's like they don't kill anybody for, you know, 50 episodes, and then it's all of a sudden, let's kill them all.
Yeah. I was like, whoa, 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 let me rewind that, because that can't be right. But yep.
Since we're talking about cartoons, I watched the latest Clone Wars tonight. Did you see it?
No.
It's got the Mandalorians in it. So they're giving a backstory to Jango Fett, his people, the Mandalorians.
Did it explain how 4,000 years before the Battle of Yavin, they invaded the Republic, right when and all the Republic was fighting them and the Jedi's were torn whether to fight the Mandalorians or not, and they did. Most of them did, and were killed by Mandalorians, which left a vacuum that the Sith then came in and took over.
It didn't say all that, but it did say that the Mandalorians fought against the Old Republic and they killed a lot of Jedis. But
yeah, okay.
And in this episode, there's some of the Mandalorians are still that way, but as a people, they've turned away from their evil, their soldiering, violent ways, and now they're peaceful. But there's a group that's trying to bring back the old ways. But it was interesting. We should end every podcast with a rant against the Clone Wars.
I should start watching them then. I haven't seen anything past season one.
Okay, well, that's all I got. That was pretty informative. This is a good one.
Yeah.
Okay, well, cool. Should we wrap it up and say goodbye?
Sure.
All right, well, thank you everyone for listening to TupaCast. If you... I lost my train of thought. Thank you everyone for...
My train of thought! Oh, that's good. I thought it was a pun. I was like, how could I put train in as a pun?
Thank you everyone for listening.
Excuse me, you messed up my pun.
What?
Yeah, hey guys, I gotta go. I hear that whistle blowing. All right, Dad, you come up with one. You could say, like, I got to get my caboose to bed. My caboose is tired.
Oh, no. I could say, well, glad it's over because I've run out of steam.
Oh, that's a good one. There you go.
That's good.
That's what I was going to say. Well, I'll do the other one then. It's time for me to get this caboose into the station. No, wait.
What? What are you talking about?
All right. Well, whatever.
Okay, bye.
Check out the website, ctupa.com. You can email me at christophertupa@hotmail. Good night.
Hey, you know, what I thought was interesting was, you know, we were talking about the, was it the Trans-U.S. Railroad? They started in the East and West. What's that called?
Transcontinental.
Okay, the Transcontinental. You talked about the Chinese and Irish labor, and we didn't mention the golden stake at the final one.
Oh, everybody knows that.
Yeah. So I guess now, they hammered a golden stake in, right? But they didn't leave it there.
Yeah, they took it out, didn't they? It's in a museum, right? And then they put a real one in?
I will assume so.
Let's go get it.
Within 2 minutes.
Yeah.
I think they melted it down and made gold commemorative coins out of it, but I could be wrong. But I don't think they left it there, because that would just be dumb.
Yeah, you can't hammer a gold spike anyway. Isn't gold too soft to hammer?
Yes.
Yeah, too malleable.
So maybe they just drilled a hole and like put it in there as a symbol and then pulled it out and melted it down and made coins.
Man, yeah, that makes sense.
We'll have to look that up too.
Yeah, we talked about that in the sequel.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you guys later.
All right. Okay. Thank y'all.
Yeah. All right. Bye.
Good night.
Good night.